Chapter 7. There's a letter from my mother to say times are hard at home. She knows my wages aren't great, and she's grateful for the $10 every week. But could I spare an extra few dollars for shoes for Michael and Alfie? She had a job taking care of an old man, but he was a great disappointment the way he died unexpected, when she thought he'd hang on to the new year, so she'd have a few shillings for shoes and Christmas dinner, ham, or something with a bit of dignity in it. She says sick people shouldn't hire people to take care of them and give them false hope of a job when they know very well they're in the throes. There's nothing coming in now but the money I'm sending, and it looks as if poor Michael would have to leave school and get a job the minute he turns 14 next year. And that's a shame. And she'd like to know, is this what we fought the English for, that half the children of Ireland should be wandering street, field and boreen, with nothing between them and their feet but the skin? I'm already sending her $10 out of the 32 I get at the Biltmore Hotel, though my pay is more like 26 when they deduct the Social Security and the income tax. After the rent I have $20 and my mother gets 10 of that, and I have 10 for food and the subway when it rains. The rest of the time I walk to save the nickel. Now and then I go mad with myself and go to a film at the 68th Street Playhouse, and I know enough to sneak in a Hershey bar or two bananas, which is the cheapest food on earth. Sometimes when I peel my banana, people from Park Avenue with sensitive noses will sniff and whisper to each other, "Is that a banana I'm smelling?" And the next thing is they're threatening to complain to the management. But I don't care anymore. If they go to the usher to complain, I'm not going to skulk in the men's room eating my banana. I'll go to the Democratic Party in the Biltmore Hotel and tell them I'm an American citizen with an Irish accent. And why am I being tormented over eating a banana during a Gary Cooper film? The winter might be coming in Ireland, but it's colder here, and the clothes I brought from Ireland are useless for a New York winter. Eddie Gilligan says if that's all I'm going to wear on the streets, I'll be dead before I'm 20. He says if I'm not too proud, I can go to that big Salvation Army place on the west side and get all the winter clothes I need for a few dollars. He says make sure I get clothes that make me look like an American and not the paddy from the bog stuff that makes me look like a turnip farmer. But I can't go to the Salvation Army now because of the $15 international money order for my mother, and I can't get leftovers from the Puerto Ricans of the Biltmore kitchen anymore for fear they might catch my eye disease. Eddie Gilligan says, there's talk about my eyes. He was called in by personnel because he's the shop steward, and they told him, I'm never to go near the kitchen again, in case I might touch a towel or something, and leave all the Puerto Rican dishwashers and Italian cooks half blind with conjunctivitis or whatever I have. The only reason I'm kept on the job at all is that I was sent by the Democratic Party, and they pay plenty for the big offices they rent in the hotel. Eddie says Mr. Carey might be a tough boss, but he stands up for his own kind and tells personnel where to get off. Tells them the minute they try to lay off a kid with bad eyes, the Democratic Party will know about it, and that'll be the end of the Biltmore Hotel. They'll see a strike that will bring out the whole goddamn hotel workers' union. No more room service, no elevators. Eddie says fat bastards will have to walk, and the chambermaids won't be putting toilet paper in the bathrooms. Imagine that. Fat old bastards stuck with nothing to wipe their asses, and all because of your bad eyes, kid. We'll walk, says Eddie, the whole goddamn union. We'll close down every hotel in the city. But I gotta tell you, they gave me the name of this eye doctor on Lexington Avenue. You gotta see him and report back in a week. The doctor's office is in an old building up four flights of stairs. Babies are crying, and a radio is playing. Boys and girls together, me and Mamie O'Rourke, we'll trip the life fantastic on the sidewalks of New York. The doctor tells me, come in, sit in this chair. What's the matter with your eyes? You here for glasses? Have some kind of infection, doctor. Jesus, yeah, that's some infection, all right. How long you had this? 9 years, doctor. I was in the eye hospital in Ireland when I was 11. He pokes at my eyes with a little piece of wood and pats them with cotton swabs which stick to the lids and make me blink. He tells me stop blinking. How the hell do I expect him to examine my eyes if I sit there blinking like a maniac? But I can't help it. The more he pokes and swabs, the more I blink, till he's so irritated he throws the stick with the swab stuck to it out the window. He pulls out drawers in his desk and curses and slams them in again, till he finds a small bottle of whiskey and a cigar. That puts him in such good humor, he sits at his desk and laughs. Still blinking, eh? Well, kid, I've been looking at eyes for 37 years, and I never saw anything like that. What are you, Mexican or something? No, I'm Irish, doctor. What you have there, they don't have that in Ireland. And that's not conjunctivitis. I know from conjunctivitis. That's something else. And I can tell you, you're lucky you have eyes at all. What you have, I saw on guys coming back from the Pacific, New Guinea and places like that. You ever in New Guinea? No, doctor. So what you have to do is shave their head completely. You got some kind of infectious dandruff like the guys from New Guinea and it's falling into your eyes. That hair will have to come off. And you'll have to scrub that scalp every day with a prescription soap. Scrub that scalp till it tingles. Scrub that scalp till it shines and come back to see me. That'll be $10, kid. The prescription soap is $2, and the Italian barber on 3rd Avenue charges me another $2 plus tip for cutting my hair and shaving my scalp. He tells me it's a crying shame shaving off a nice head of hair. If he had a head of hair like that, they'd have to cut off his head to get it. That most of these doctors don't know shit from shinola anyway, but if that's what I want, who is he to object? He holds up a mirror to show how bald I look in the back, and I feel weak with the shame of it. The bald head, the red eyes, the pimples, the bad teeth. And if anyone looks at me on Lexington Avenue, I'll push him into the traffic because I'm sorry I ever came to America, which threatens to fire me over my eyes and makes me go bald through the streets of New York. Of course they stare at me in the streets, and I want to stare back in a threatening way, but I can't with the yellow ooze in my eyes mixing with strands of cotton and blinding me entirely. I look up and down side streets for the ones least crowded, and I zigzag across town and up. The best street is 3rd Avenue, with the L rattling overhead and shadows everywhere, and people in bars with their own troubles, minding their own business, and not staring at every pair of sore eyes that passes by. People coming out of banks and dress shops always stare, but people in bars brood over their drinks and wouldn't care if you went eyeless in the avenue. Of course, Mrs. Austin is gawking out the basement window. No sooner am I in the front door than she's up the stairs asking what happened to my head. Did I have an accident? Was I in a fire or something? And I want to snap at her and say, does this look like a damn fire? But I tell her my hair was only singed in the hotel kitchen, and the barber said it would be better to cut it off at the roots and start all over again. I have to be polite to Mrs. Austin for fear she might tell me pack up and leave. And dare I be out in the street on a Saturday with a brown suitcase and a bald head, $3 to my name? She says, well, you're young, and goes back downstairs, and all I could do is lie in my bed listening to people on the street talking and laughing, wondering how I can go to work on Monday morning in my baldy condition, even if I am obeying the hotel and the doctor's orders. I keep going to the mirror in my room, shocking myself with the whiteness of my scalp. I'm wishing I could stay here till the hair comes back, but I'm hungry. Mrs. Austin forbids food and drink in the room, but once the darkness falls, I go up the street for the big Sunday Times that will shield the bag with a sweet bun and a pint of milk from Mrs. Austin's gawk. Now I have less than $2 to last me till Friday, and here it is, only Saturday. If she stops me, I'll say, why shouldn't I have a sweet bun and a pint of milk? After the way the doctor told me I had a New Guinea disease and a barber shaved my head to the bone. I wonder about all those films where they're waving the stars and stripes and placing their hands on their chest and declaring to the world this is the land of the free and the home of the brave. And you know yourself you can't even go to see Hamlet with your lemon meringue pie and your ginger ale or a banana, and you can't go into Mrs. Austin's with any food or drink. But Mrs. Austin doesn't appear. Landladies never appear when you don't care. I can't read the Times unless I wash out my eyes in the bathroom with warm water and toilet paper. And it's lovely to lie in the bed with the paper and the bun and the milk till Mrs. Austin calls up the stairs complaining her electric bills are sky high. And would I kindly put out the light? She's not a millionaire. Once I switch off the light, I remember it's time to smear my scalp with ointment. But then I realize if I lie down, the ointment will be all over the pillow and Mrs. Austin will be at me again. The only thing to do is to sit up with my head resting against the iron bedstead where I can wipe off any stray ointment. The iron is made up of little scrolls and flaws with petals that stick out and make it impossible to get a decent sleep. And the only thing I can do is to get out and sleep on the floor, where Mrs. Austin will have nothing to complain about. Monday morning, there's a note on my time card telling me, report to the 19th floor. Eddie Gilligan says it's nothing personal, but they don't want me in the lobby anymore with the bad eyes and now the bald head. It's a well-known fact that people who lose their hair suddenly are not long for this world, even if you were to stand up in the middle of the lobby and announce it was the barber who did it. People want to believe the worst, and they're in the personnel office saying, bad eyes, bald head, put the two together, and you have big problems with the guests in the lobby. When the hair grows back and the eyes clear up, I might be returned to the lobby, maybe as busboy someday. And I'd be making tips so big, I'd be able to support my family in Limerick in high style, but not now. Not with this head. These eyes. Chapter 8. Eddie Gilligan works on the 19th floor with his brother Joe. Our job is to set up for functions, meetings in rooms, and banquets and weddings in the ballroom. And Joe isn't much use the way his hands and fingers are like roots. He walks around with a long-handled broom in one hand and a cigarette in the other, pretending to look busy, but he spends most of his time in the lavatory, or smoking with Digger Moon, the carpet man, who claims he's a Blackfoot Indian, and can lay carpet faster and tighter than anyone in the U.S. of A., unless he's had a few, and then watch out, because he remembers the sufferings of his people. When Digger remembers the sufferings of his people, the only man he can talk to is Joe Gilligan, because Joe himself is suffering with arthritis, and Digger says, Joe understands. When you have arthritis so bad you can barely wipe your ass, you understand all kinds of suffering. That's what Digger says. And when Digger isn't going from floor to floor laying carpet or pulling up carpet, he sits cross-legged on the floor of the carpet room, suffering with Joe, one with the past, the other with arthritis. No one is going to bother Digger or Joe because everyone in the Biltmore Hotel knows of their suffering, and they can spend days in the carpet room or stepping across the street to McCann's bar for relief. Mr. Carey himself suffers with a bad stomach. He makes his inspection rounds in the morning, suffering from the breakfast his wife cooks, and on the afternoon inspection, he's suffering from the lunch his wife packs. He tells Eddie his wife is a beautiful woman, the only one he ever loved, but she's killing him slowly, and she's not in such good shape herself with her legs all swollen with rheumatism. Eddie tells Mr. Carey his wife is in bad shape too, after 4 miscarriages, and now some kind of blood infection that has the doctor worried. The morning we set up for the annual banquet of the American Irish Historical Society, Eddie and Mr. Carey stand at the entrance to the 19th floor ballroom. Eddie smoking a cigarette, and Mr. Carey in his double-breasted suit, draped nicely to make you think he doesn't have that much of a belly, stroking it to ease the pain. Eddie tells Mr. Carey he never smoked till he was hit on Omaha Beach, and some asshole, excuse the language, Mr. Carey, shoved the cigarette in his mouth while he was lying there waiting for the medics. He took a drag on that cigarette and it gave him such relief lying there with his gut hanging out in Omaha Beach. He's been smoking ever since. Can't give him up. Tried, Christ knows, but can't. Now Digger Moon strolls up with a huge carpet on his shoulder and tells Eddie something has to be done about his brother Joe, that poor son of a bitch is suffering more than 7 Indian tribes and Digger knows something about suffering after his stint with the infantry all over the goddamn Pacific when he was hit with everything the Japs could throw at him, malaria, everything. Eddie says, yeah, yeah, he knows about Joe and he's sorry. After all, it's his brother, but he has his own troubles with his wife and her miscarriages and blood infection and his own gut messed up from not being put back right. And he worries about Joe the way he mixes alcohol and all kinds of painkillers. Mr. Carey belches and groans and Digger says, you still eating shit? Because Digger isn't afraid of Mr. Carey or anyone else. That's how it is when you're a great carpet man. You can say what you like to anyone, and if they fire you, there's always a job in the Hotel Commodore or the Hotel Roosevelt or even, Jesus, yeah, the Waldorf Astoria, where they're always trying to steal Digger away. Some days Digger is so overcome by the sufferings of his people, he refuses to lay any carpet. And when Mr. Carey won't fire him, Digger says, that's right. White man can't get along without us Indians. White men gotta have Iroquois 60 floors up the skyscrapers to dance along steel beams. White men gotta have Blackfoot to lay good carpet. Every time Digger hears Mr. Carey belch, he tells him stop eating shit and have a nice beer because beer never bothered nobody. And it's Mrs. Carey's sandwiches that are killing Mr. Carey. Digger tells Mr. Carey he has a theory about women, that they're like black widow spiders who kill the males after they screw, bite their goddamn heads off, that women don't care about men. Once they're past the age of having kids, men are really useless, unless they're up on the horse attacking another tribe. Eddie Gilligan says you look pretty fucking silly riding your horse up Madison Avenue to attack another tribe, and Digger says that's exactly what he means. He says a man is put on this earth to paint his face, ride the horse, throw the spear, kill the other tribe. And when Eddie says, oh, bullshit, Digger says, oh, bullshit my ass. What are you doing, Eddie? Spending your life here setting up for dinners and weddings? Is that the way for a man to live? Eddie shrugs and puffs in his cigarette, and when Digger suddenly swings around to walk away, he catches Mr. Carey and Eddie with the end of the carpet and knocks them 5 feet into the ballroom. It's an accident, and no one says anything, but still, I admire the way Digger goes through the world, not giving a fiddler's fart like my Uncle Pan Limerick, just because no one can lay carpet like him. I wish I could be like Digger, but not with carpets. I hate carpets. If I had the money, I could buy a torch and read till dawn. In America, a torch is called a flashlight. A biscuit is called a cookie. A bun is a roll. Confectionery is pastry. And mincemeat is ground. Men wear pants instead of trousers. And they'll even say this pant leg is shorter than the other, which is silly. When I hear them say pant leg, I feel like breathing faster. The lift is an elevator. And if you want a WC or a lavatory, you have to say bathroom, even if there isn't a sign of a bath there. And no one dies in America. They pass away or they're deceased. And when they die, the body, which is called the remains, is taken to a funeral home where people just stand around and look at it. No one sings or tells a story or takes a drink. And then it's taken away in a casket to be interred. They don't like saying coffin and they don't like saying buried. They never say graveyard. Cemetery sounds nicer. If I had the money, I could buy a hat and go out. But I can't wander the streets of Manhattan in my bald state, for fear people might think they're looking at a snowball on a pair of scrawny shoulders. In a week, when the hair darkens my scalp, I'll be able to go out again, and there's nothing Mrs. Austin can do about that. That's what gives me such pleasure, lying in the bed and thinking of the things you can do that nobody else can interfere with. That's what Mr. O'Halloran, the headmaster, used to tell us in school in Limerick. Your mind is a treasure house that you should stock well, and it's the one part of you the world can't interfere with. New York was the city of my dreams, but now I'm here the dreams are gone. That's not what I expected at all. I never thought I'd be going around the hotel lobby cleaning up after people and scouring toilet bowls in the lavatories. How could I ever write my mother or anyone in Limerick and tell them the way I'm living in this rich land with $2 to last me for a week, a bald head and sore eyes, and a landlady who won't let me turn on the light? How could I ever tell them I have to eat bananas every day, the cheapest food in the world, because the hotel won't let me near the kitchen for leftovers for fear the Puerto Ricans might catch my New Guinea infection? They'd never believe me. They'd say, go away or that. And they'd laugh because all you have to do is look at the films to see how well off the Americans are, the way they fiddle with their food and leave something on their plate, and then push the plate away. It's hard even to feel sorry for Americans who are supposed to be poor in a film like The Grapes of Wrath, when everything dries up and they have to move to California. At least they're dry and warm. My Uncle Pat Keating used to say, if we had a California in Ireland, the whole country would flock there, eat oranges galore, and spend the whole day swimming. When you're in Ireland, it's hard to believe there are poor people in America because you see the Irish coming back. Return Yanks, they're called. You could spot them a mile away with their fat arses waggling along O'Connell Street in trousers too tight and colours you'd never see in Ireland, blues, pinks, light greens, and even flashes of puce. They always act rich and talk through their noses about their refrigerators and automobiles. And if they go into a pub, they want American drinks no one ever heard of. Cocktails, if you don't mind. Though, if you act like that in a Limerick pub, the barman will put you in your place and remind you how you went to America with your arse hanging out of your trousers. And don't be putting on airs here, Mick. I knew you when the snot hung from your nose to your kneecaps. You can always spot the real Yanks, too, with their light collars and fat arses, and the way they look around and smile and give pennies to raggedy children. Real Yanks don't put on airs. They don't have to after coming from a country where everyone has everything. If Mrs. Austin won't let me have a light, I can still sit up in the bed or lie down, or I can decide to stay in or go out. I won't go out tonight because of my bald head, and I don't mind because I can stay here and turn my mind into a film about Limerick. This is the greatest discovery I've made from lying in the room. That if I can't read because of my eyes, or Mrs. Austin complaining about the light, I can start any kind of a film in my head. If it's midnight here, it's 5 in the morning in Limerick, and I can picture my mother and brothers asleep with the dog Lucky growling at the world, and my uncle Ab Sheehan snorting away in his bed from all the pints he had the night before, and farting from his great feed of fish and chips. I can float through Limerick and see people shuffling through the streets for the first Sunday Mass. I can go in and out of churches, shops, pubs, graveyards, and see people asleep or groaning with pain in the hospital at the city home. It's magic to go back to Limerick in my mind, even when it brings the tears. It's hard to pass through the lanes of the poor and look into their houses and hear babies crying and women trying to start fires to boil water in kettles for the breakfast of tea and bread. It's hard to see children shivering when they have to leave their beds for school or mass. There's no heat in the house like the heat we have here in New York, with radiators singing away at 6 in the morning. I'd like to empty out the lanes of Limerick and bring all the poor people to America and put them in houses with heat, and give them warm clothes and shoes, and let them stuff themselves with porridge and sausages. Someday I'll make millions and I'll bring the poor people to America and send them back to Limerick, fat-arsed and waddling up and down O'Connell Street in light colours. I can do anything I like in this bed, anything. I can dream about Limerick or I can interfere with myself even if it's a sin, and Mrs. Austin will never know. No one will ever know unless I go to confession, and I'm too doomed for that. Other nights when I have hair on my head and no money, I can walk around Manhattan. I don't mind that one bit because the streets are as lively as any film at the 68th Street Playhouse. There's always a fire engine screaming around the corner, or an ambulance or a police car, and sometimes they come screaming together and you know there's a fire. People always watch for the fire engine to slow down, and that tells you what block to go to and where to look for smoke and flames. If someone is at a window ready to jump, that makes it more exciting. The ambulance will wait with flashing lights and cops will tell everyone, move back. That's the main job of cops in New York, telling everyone, move back. They're powerful with their guns and sticks, but the real hero is the fireman, especially if he climbs a ladder and plucks a child from a window. He could save an old man with crutches and nothing on but a nightshirt, but it's different when it's a child sucking her thumb and resting her curly head on the fireman's broad shoulder. That's when we all cheer and look at each other and know we're all happy about the same thing. And that's what makes us look in the daily news the next day, to see if there's any chance we might be in the picture with the brave fireman and the curly-haired child. Chapter 9. Mrs. Austin tells me her sister Hannah, that's married to the Irishman, is coming for a little visit on Christmas before they go out to her house in Brooklyn, and she'd like to meet me. We'll have a sandwich and a little Christmas drink, and that will get Hannah's mind off her troubles with that crazy Irishman. Mrs. Austin doesn't understand herself why Hannah would want to spend Christmas Eve with the likes of me and other Irishmen. But she was always a bit strange, and maybe she likes the Irish after all. Their mother warned them a long time ago back in Sweden, over 20 years, would you believe it, to stay away from Irishmen and Jews, to marry their own kind, and Mrs. Austin doesn't mind telling me her husband Eugene was half Swedish, half Hungarian, that never drank a drop in his life, though he loved to eat, and that's what killed him in the end. She doesn't mind telling me he was big as a house when he died, that when she wasn't cooking, he was raiding the refrigerator, and when they got a TV set, that was really the end of him. He'd sit there eating and drinking and worrying about the state of the world so much his heart just stopped, just like that. She misses him, and it's hard after 23 years, especially when they had no kids. Her sister Hannah has 5 kids, and that's because the Irishman won't ever leave her alone a couple of drinks and he's jumping on her, just like a typical Irish Catholic. Eugene wasn't like that. He had respect. In any case, she'll expect to see me after work on Christmas Eve. On the day itself, Mr. Carey invites the houseman of the hotel and 4 chambermaid supervisors to his office for a little Christmas drink. There's a bottle of Paddy's Irish whiskey and a bottle of 4 Roses, which Digger Moon won't touch. He wants to know why anyone would drink piss like 4 Roses when they can have the best thing that ever came out of Ireland, the whiskey. Mr. Carey strokes his belly along the double-breasted suit and says it's all the same to him, he can't drink anything. It would kill him. But drink anyway, here's to a Merry Christmas, and who knows what the next year will bring. Joe Gilligan is already smiling from whatever he's been swigging all day from the flask in his back pocket, and between that and the arthritis, there's the odd stumble. Mr. Carey tells him, "Here, Joe, sit in my chair." And when Joe tries to sit, he lets out a great groan, and there are tears on his cheeks. Mrs. Hines, the head of all the chambermaids, goes over to him and holds his head against her chest and pats him and rocks him. She says, "Ah, poor Joe, poor Joe. I don't know how the good Lord could twist your bones after what you did for America in the war." Digger Moon says that's where Joe got the arthritis, in the goddamn Pacific, where they have every goddamn disease known to man. "Remember this, Joe, was the goddamn Japs gave you that arthritis the way they gave me the malaria. We haven't been the same since, Joe, you and me." Mr. Carey tells him, take it easy with the language. There are ladies present, and Digger says, "Okay, Mr. Carey, I respect you for that. And it's Christmas, so what the hell?" Mrs. Hines says, "That's right, it's Christmas, and we must love each other and forgive our enemies." Digger says, "Forgive my ass. I don't forgive the white man, and I don't forgive the Japs, but I forgive you, Joe. You suffered more than 10 Indian tribes with that goddamn arthritis." When he grabs Joe's hand to shake it, Joe howls with pain, and Mr. Carey says, "Digger, Digger." Mrs. Hines says, "Will you for the love of Jesus have respect for Joe's arthritis?" Digger says, "Sorry, ma'am. I have the greatest respect for Joe's arthritis," and to prove it, he holds a large glass of Paddy's to Joe's lips. Eddie Gilligan stands over in a corner with his glass, and I wonder why he looks and says nothing when the world is worried about his brother. I know he has his own troubles with his wife's blood infection, but I can't understand why he won't at least stand closer to his brother. Jerry Kerisk whispers we should get away from this crazy crowd and have a beer. I don't like spending money in bars with the trouble my mother is in, but it's Christmas, and the whiskey I had already makes me feel better about myself and the world in general. And why shouldn't I be good to myself? It's the first time in my life I ever drank whiskey like a man, and now that I'm in a bar with Jerry, I can talk and not worry about my eyes or anything. Now I can ask Jerry why Eddie Gilligan is so cold to his brother. Women, says Jerry. Eddie was engaged to this girl when he was drafted, but when he went away, she and Joe fell in love. And when she sent Eddie back the engagement ring, he went crazy and said he'd killed Joe the minute he saw him. But Eddie was sent to Europe and Joe to the Pacific, and they were busy killing other people. And while they were away, Joe's wife, the one Eddie was supposed to marry, started drinking and now makes Joe's life hell. Eddie said that was punishment for the son of a bitch for stealing his girl. He met a nice Italian girl himself in the army, a whack, but she has the blood infection, and you'd think there's a curse on the whole Gilligan family. Jerry says he thinks the Irish mothers are right after all. You should marry your own kind Irish Catholics and make sure they're not alcoholics or Italians with blood infections. He laughs when he says that, but there's something serious in his eyes, and I don't see anything. Because I know I don't want to marry an Irish Catholic myself and spend the rest of my life dragging the kids to confession and communion and saying, yes, Father, oh, indeed, Father, every time I see a priest. Jerry wants to stay in the bar and drink more beer, and he turns peevish when I tell him I have to visit Mrs. Austin and her sister Hannah. Why would I want to spend Christmas Eve with two old Swedish women, 40 years old at least, when I could be having a grand time for myself with girls from Mayo and Kerry up at Islands 32? Why? I can't answer him because I don't know where I want to be or what I'm supposed to do. That's what you're faced with when you come to America, one decision after another. I knew what to do in Limerick, and I had answers for questions, but this is my first Christmas Eve in New York, and here I am, pulled one way by Jerry Kerisk, Islands 32, the promise of girls from Mayo and Kerry, and the other way by two old Swedish women, one always gawking out the window in case I might smuggle in food or drink, the other unhappy with her Irish husband, and who knows what way she'll jump. I'm afraid if I don't go to Mrs. Austin, she might turn savage on me and tell me leave, and there I'll be out in the street on Christmas Eve with my brown suitcase and only a few dollars left after sending money home, paying my rent, and now buying beer right and left in this bar. After all this, I can't afford to spend the night doling out beer money for the women of Ireland, and that's the part that Jerry understands, the part that takes away his peevishness. He knows money has to be sent home. He says, Happy Christmas, and laughs. I know you'll have a wild night with the old Swedish girls. The barman has his ear cocked and he says, mind yourself at them Swedish parties. They'll be giving you their native drink, the glug, and if you drink that stuff, you won't know Christmas Eve from the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. It's black and thick, and you need a strong constitution for it. And then they make you eat all kinds of fish with it, raw fish, salty fish, smoked fish, all kinds of fish you wouldn't give a cat. The Swedes drink that glug and it makes them so crazy they think they're Vikings all over again. Jerry says he didn't know the Swedes were Vikings. He thought you had to be a Dane. Not at all, said the barman. All them people in northern places were Vikings. Wherever you saw ice, you were sure to see a Viking. Jerry says it's remarkable the things people know. And the barman says, I could tell you a story or two. Jerry orders one more beer for the road, and I drink it, though I don't know what's going to become of me after my two large whiskies in Mr. Carey's office and four beers here with Jerry. I don't know how I'm going to face a night of glug and all kinds of fish if the barman is right in his prophecy. We walk up Third Avenue singing Don't Fence Me In, with people rushing past us frantic over Christmas, giving us nothing but hard stares. There are dancing Christmas lights everywhere, but up around Bloomingdale's the lights dance too much and I have to hold on to a Third Avenue L-pillar and throw up. Jerry pushes in my stomach with his fist. Get it all up, he says, and you have plenty of room for the glug and you'll be a new man tomorrow. Then he says, glug, 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 and laughs so hard over the sound of the word he's nearly hit by a car, and a cop tells us move on. That we should be ashamed of ourselves, Irish kids that should respect the birthday of the Savior, God damn it. There's a diner at 67th Street and Jerry says I should have coffee to straighten me out before I see the Swedes. He'll pay for it. We sit at the counter and he tells me he's not going to spend the rest of his life working like a slave at the Biltmore Hotel. He's not going to wind up like the Gilligans who fought for the USA. What the hell did they get for it? Arthritis and wives with blood infections and drinking problems. That's what they got. Oh, no. Jerry is heading for the Catskill Mountains on Memorial Day, the end of May. The Irish Alps. Plenty of work up there, waiting on tables, cleaning up anything, and the tips are good. There are Jewish places up there too, but they're not too active in the tipping department because they pay for everything in advance and they don't have to carry cash. The Irish drink and leave money on tables or the floor. When you clean up, it's all yours. Sometimes they come back squawking, but you didn't see a thing. You don't know nothing. You just sweep up the way you're paid to. Of course they don't believe you and they call you a liar and say things about your mother, but there's nothing they can do except take their business elsewhere. There are plenty of girls up in the Catskills. Some places have outdoor dances, and all you have to do is waltz your Mary into the woods, and before you know it, you're in a state of mortal sin. The Irish girls are mad for it once they get to the Catskills. They're hopeless in the city, the way they all work in fancy places like Schraff's, with the little black dresses and little white aprons. Ah, yes, ma'am. Ah, indeed, ma'am. Are the mashed potatoes a little too lumpy, ma'am? But get them up in the mountains and they're like cats up the pole getting pregnant. And before they know what hit them, dozens of Seans and Kevins are dragging their arses up the aisle with the priest glaring at them and the girls' big brothers threatening them. I want to sit in the diner all night, listening to Jerry talking about Irish girls in the Catskills. But the man says it's Christmas Eve and he's closing out of respect to his Christian customers, even though he's Greek. And it's not really his Christmas. Jerry wants to know how it could not be his Christmas since all you have to do is look out the window for proof. But the Greek says, we're different. That's enough for Jerry, who doesn't argue about such things, and that's what I like about him. The way he goes through life having another beer and dreaming of grand times in the Catskills and not arguing with Greeks about Christmas. I wish it could be like him, but there's always some dark cloud at the back of my head. Swedish women waiting for me with glug or a letter from my mother saying thanks for the few dollars. Michael and Alfie will have shoes and we'll have a nice goose for Christmas with the help of God and his blessed mother. She never mentions she needs shoes for herself. And once I think of that, I know I'll have another dark cloud at the back of my head. I wish there was a little panel I could slide back to release the clouds, but there isn't. And I'll have to find another way or stop collecting dark clouds. The Greek says, good night, gentlemen. And would we like to take some day-old donuts? Take them, he says, or I throw out. Jerry says he'll have one to keep him going to Ireland's 32, where he'll have a feed of corned beef and cabbage and floury white potatoes. The Greek fills a bag with donuts confectionery and tells me I look like I could use a decent meal, so I'll take the bag. Jerry says goodnight at 68th Street, and I wish I could go with him. The whole day has me dizzy, and it's still not over with the Swedes there waiting, stirring the glug, slicing the raw fish. The thought of it makes me puke all over again there on the street, and people passing by, frantic with Christmas, make sounds of disgust and step away from me, telling the little children, don't look at that disgusting man, he's a drunk. I want to tell them, please don't turn the little children against me. I want to tell them, this is not a habit I have. There are clouds at the back of my head. My mother has a goose, at least, but she needs shoes. But there's no use trying to talk to people with parcels and children by the hand, and their heads ringing with Christmas carols because they're going home to bright apartments. And they know God's in his heaven, all's right with the world, as the poet said. Mrs. Austin opens the door. Oh, look, Hannah. Mr. McCourt brought us a whole bag of donuts and pastries. Hannah gives a little wave from the couch and says, that's nice. You never know when you might need a bag of donuts. I always thought the Irish brought a bottle, but you're different. Give the boy a drink, Stephanie. Hannah is drinking red wine, but Mrs. Austin goes to a bowl on the table and ladles out the black stuff into a glass, the glug. My stomach turns again and I have to control it. Sit down, says Hannah. Let me tell you something, Irish boy. I don't give a shit about your people. You may be nice. My sister says you're nice. You bring nice donuts. But right under your skin, you're nothing but shit. Please, Hannah, says Mrs. Austin. Please, Hannah, my ass. What did you people ever do for the world besides drink? Stephanie, give him some fish. Decent Swedish food. Moonface Mick. You make me sick, you little Mick. Uh-huh. Do you hear the poetry in that? She cackles away over her poetry, and I don't know what to do with my glug in one hand and Mrs. Austin pushing fish at me with the other. Mrs. Austin is drinking the glug, too, and she staggers from me to the bowl to the couch where Hannah is holding out her glass for more wine. She slurps her wine and glares at me. She says, a kid I was when I married that Mick. 19. How many years ago? Jesus, 21. What are you, Stephanie, 40-something? Wasted my life on that Mick. What are you doing here? Who sent you? Mrs. Austin. Mrs. Austin, Mrs. Austin, speak up, you little spud shitter. Drink your glug and speak up. Mrs. Austin sways before me with her glug glass. Come on, Eugene, let's go to bed. Oh, I'm not Eugene, Mrs. Austin. Oh. She turns and wobbles away into another room, and Hannah cackles again. See that? She still doesn't know she's a widow. Wish I was a goddamn widow. The glug I drank is making my stomach turn, and I try to rush to the street, but the door has three locks, and I'm throwing up in the basement vestibule before I can get out. Hannah lurches from the couch and tells me, get into the kitchen, get a mop and soap, and clean up this goddamn mess. Don't you know it's Christmas Eve, for Christ's sakes, and is this how you treat your gracious host? From kitchen to door, I go with dripping mop, swabbing, squeezing, rinsing in the kitchen sink and back again. Hannah pats my shoulder and kisses my ear and tells me I'm not such a bad Mick after all, that I must have been well brought up the way I clean my mess. She tells me help myself to anything, glug, fish, even one of my own donuts. But I place the mop back where I found it and walk past Hannah with the idea in my head that once I cleaned up, I don't have to listen to her anymore or anyone like her. She calls to me. Where are you going? Where the hell do you think you're going? But I'm up the stairs to my room, my bed, so that I can lie there listening to Christmas carols on the radio, with the world spinning around me and a great wonder in my head about the rest of my life in America. If I wrote to anyone in Limerick and told them about my Christmas Eve in New York, they'd say I was making it up. They'd say New York must be a lunatic asylum. In the morning, there's a knock at my door, and it's Mrs. Austin in dark glasses. Hannah is farther down the stairs, and she's in dark glasses, too. Mrs. Austin says she heard I had an accident in her apartment, but no one can blame her or her sister since they were prepared to offer the finest of Swedish hospitality. And if I chose to arrive at that little party in a certain state, they couldn't be blamed, and it's too bad because they wanted nothing but a truly Christian Christmas Eve. And I just want to tell you, Mr. McCoy, we don't appreciate your behavior one bit. Isn't that right, Hannah? There's a croak from Hannah as she coughs and puffs on a cigarette. They go back down the stairs, and I want to call after Mrs. Austin to see if there's any chance she could spare me a donut from the Greek's bag, since I'm so empty from all the throwing up last night. But they're out the door, and from my window, I can see them loading Christmas parcels into a car and driving off. I can stand at the window all day looking at the happy people with children by the hand going off to church, as they say in America. Or I can sit up in the bed with Crime and Punishment and see what Raskolnikov is up to, but that would stir up all kinds of guilt. And I don't have the strength for it, and it's not the right kind of reading for a Christmas day anyway. I'd like to go up the street for communion at St. Vincent Ferrer's, but it's years since I went to confession, and my soul is as black as Mrs. Austin's glug. The happy Catholic people with children by the hand are surely going to St. Vincent's, and if I follow them, I'm bound to have a Christmas feeling. It's lovely to go into a church like St. Vincent's, where you know the Mass will be just like the Mass in Limerick or anywhere in the world. You could go to Samoa or Kabul, and they'd have the same Mass, and even if they wouldn't let me be an altar boy in Limerick, I still have the Latin my father taught me. and no matter where I go, I can respond to the priest. No one can scoop out the contents of my head. All the saints' feast days I know by heart, the Mass Latin, the chief towns and products of the 32 counties of Ireland, songs galore of Ireland's sufferings, and Oliver Goldsmith's lovely poem, The Deserted Village. They could put me in jail and throw away the key, but they could never stop me from dreaming my way around Limerick and out along the banks of the Shannon, or thinking about Raskolnikov and his troubles. The people who go to St. Vincent's are like the ones who go to the 68th Street Playhouse for Hamlet, and they know the Latin responses the way they know the play. They share prayer books and sing hymns together and smile at each other because they know Bridget the maid is back there in the Park Avenue kitchen, keeping an eye on the turkey. Their sons and daughters have the look of coming home from school and college, and they smile at other people in the pews also home from school and college. They can afford to smile because they all have teeth so dazzling, if they dropped them in snow, they'd be lost forever. The church is so crowded, there are people standing in the back. But I'm so weak with the hunger and the long Christmas Eve of whiskey, glug, and throwing up, I want to find a seat. There's an empty spot at the end of a pew far up the center aisle. But as soon as I slip into it, a man comes running at me. He's all dressed up in striped trousers, a coat with tails, and a frown all over his face, and he whispers to me, "You must leave this pew at once. This is for regular pew holders. Come on, come on." I feel my face turning red, and that means my eyes are worse. And when I go down the aisle, I know the whole world is looking at me, the one who sneaked into the pew of a happy family with children home from school and college. There's no use even standing at the back of the church. They all know and they'll be giving me looks, so I might as well leave and add another sin to the hundreds already on my soul, the mortal sin of not going to Mass on Christmas Day. At least God will know I tried. It's not my fault if I wandered into a happy family from Park Avenue pew. I'm so empty now and hungry, I want to go mad with myself and have a feast at the Horn and Hard at autumn at. But I don't want to be seen there for fear people might think I'm like the ones who sit there half the day with a cup of coffee and old newspaper and nowhere to go. There's a chock full of nuts a few blocks away, and that's where I have a bowl of pea soup, a nut of cheese and raisin bread, a cup of coffee, a donut with white sugar, and a read of the Journal American that someone left behind. It's only 2 p.m. I don't know what to do with myself when all the libraries are closed. People walking by with children by the hand might think I have nowhere to go, so I keep my head up and walk up one street and down the other as if I were rushing for a turkey dinner. I wish I could open a door somewhere and have people say, "Oh, hi, Frank, you're just in time." The people walking here and there on the streets of New York take it all for granted. They bring presents and get presents and have their big Christmas dinners. And they never know there are people walking up one street and down the other on the holiest day of the year. I wish I could be an ordinary New Yorker stuffed after my dinner, talking to my family with Christmas carols on the radio in the background. Or I wouldn't mind being back in Limerick with my mother and brothers and the nice goose. But here I am in the place I always dreamed about, New York, and I'm worn out with all these streets where there isn't even a bird to be seen. There's nothing to do but go back to my room, listen to the radio, read Crime and Punishment, and fall asleep, wondering why Russians have to drag things out. You'd never find a New York detective wandering around with the likes of Raskolnikov, talking about everything but the murder of the old woman. The New York detective would nab him, book him, and the next thing is the electric chair in Sing Sing. And that's because Americans are busy people with no time for detectives to be chatting with people they already know committed the murder. There's a knock on the door, and it's Mrs. Austin. "Mr. McCourt," she says, "would you come downstairs a minute?" I don't know what to say. I'd like to tell her kiss my arse after the way her sister talked to me and the way she talked to me herself this morning, but I follow her down. There she has all kinds of food laid out on the table. She says she brought it from her sisters, that they were worried I might have no place to go or nothing to eat on this beautiful day. She's sorry about the way she talked to me this morning and hopes I'm in a forgiving mood. There's turkey and stuffing and all kinds of potatoes, white and yellow, with cranberry sauce to make everything sweet, and all this puts me in a forgiving mood. She'd give me some glug, but her sister threw it out, and it's just as well. Made everyone sick. When I'm finished, she invites me to sit and watch her new television set, where there's a program about Jesus that's so holy I fall asleep in the armchair. When I awake, the clock on her mantelpiece says 4:20 in the morning, and Mrs. Austin is in the other room letting out little cries, Eugene, Eugene. And that proves you can have a sister and go to her house for Christmas dinner, but if you don't have your Eugene, you're as lonely as anyone sitting in the automat. And it's a great comfort to know my mother and brothers in Limerick have a goose, and next year, when I'm promoted to busboy at the Biltmore, I'll send them the money that will let them stroll around Limerick, dazzling the world with their new shoes. Chapter 10. Eddie Gilligan tells me go to the lockers and get into my street clothes, because there's a priest in Mr. Carey's office who met me coming over on the ship, and now wants to take me to lunch. Then he says, what are you blushing for? It's only a priest, and you're getting the free lunch. I wish I could say I don't want to meet the priest for lunch, but Eddie and Mr. Carey might ask questions. If a priest says come to lunch, you have to go, and it doesn't matter what happened in the hotel room, even if it wasn't my fault. I could never tell Eddie or Mr. Carey how the priest came at me. They'd never believe me. People sometimes say things about priests, that they're fat or pompous or mean. But no one would ever believe a priest would interfere with you in a hotel room, especially people like Eddie or Mr. Carey, with sick wives always running to confession in case they die in their sleep. People like that wouldn't be surprised if priests walked on water. Why can't this priest go back to Los Angeles and leave me alone? Why is he taking me to lunch when he should be out there visiting the sick and the dying? That's what priests are for. It's 4 months since he went off to that retreat house in Virginia to beg forgiveness, and here he is, still on this side of the continent, with nothing on his mind but lunch. Now Eddie comes to me in the locker room and tells me the priest had another idea. Meet him across the street in McCann's. It's hard to walk into a restaurant and sit down opposite a priest who came at you in a hotel room 4 months ago. It's hard to know what to do when he looks at you directly, shakes your hand, holds your elbow, eases you into your seat. He tells me I'm looking good, that I filled out a bit in the face, and I must be eating right. He says America is a great country if you give it a chance. But I could tell him how they won't let the Puerto Ricans give me leftovers anymore, and how I'm weary of bananas. But I don't want to say much in case he might think I've forgotten the Hotel New Yorker. I don't have any grudge against him. He didn't hit anyone or starve anyone, and what he did came from the drink. What he did was not as bad as running off to England and leaving your wife and children to starve the way my father did, but what he did was bad because he's a priest, and they're not supposed to murder people or interfere with them in any way. And what he did makes me wonder if there are any other priests wandering the world going at people in hotel rooms. There he is, gazing at me with his big grey eyes, his face all scrubbed and shiny, with his black suit and his gleaming white collar, telling me he wanted to make this one stop before returning to Los Angeles forever. It's easy to see how pleased he is to be in a state of grace after his 4 months in the retreat house, and I know now it's hard for me to eat a hamburger with someone in such a state of grace. It's hard to know what to do with my own eyes when he gazes at me as if I were the one who went at someone in a hotel room. I'd like to be able to look right back at him, but all I know of priests is what I've seen of them on altars, pulpits, and the darkness of confessionals. He's probably thinking, I've been up to all kinds of sin, and he's right, but at least I'm not a priest, and I never bothered anyone else. He tells the waiter, yes, a hamburger is fine, and no, no, Lord, no, he won't have a beer. Water's fine, nothing alcoholic will ever cross his lips again, and he smiles at me as if I should understand what he's talking about, and the waiter smiles too, as if to say, isn't this a saintly priest? He tells me he went to confession to a bishop in Virginia, and even though he received absolution and spent 4 months in work and prayer, he feels it wasn't enough. He's given up his parish, and he spends the rest of his days with the poor Mexicans and Negroes in Los Angeles. He calls for the bill, tells me he never wants to see me again, it's too painful, but he'll remember me in his masses. He says I should be careful of the Irish curse, the drink, and whenever I'm tempted to sin, I should meditate like him on the purity of the Virgin Mary. Good luck. God bless. Go to night school. And he's into a taxi to Idlewild Airport. There are days the rain is so heavy, I have to spend a dime on the subway. And I see people my own age with books and bags that say Columbia, Fordham, NYU, City College. And I know I want to be one of them, a student. I know I don't want to spend years in the Biltmore Hotel, setting up banquets and meetings, and I don't want to be the houseman, cleaning up in the Palm Court. I don't even want to be a busboy, getting a share of the waiter's tips, which they get from the rich students who drink their gin and tonic. Talk about Hemingway. And where should they have dinner, and should they go to Venice's party in Sutton Place? It was such a bore last year. I don't want to be a houseman where people look at me as if I were part of a wall. I see the college students in the subway, and I dream that someday I'll be like them, carrying my books, listening to professors, graduating with a cap and gown, going on to a job where I wear a suit and tie and carry a briefcase, go home on the train every night, kiss the wife, eat my dinner, play with the kids, read a book, have the excitement with the wife, go to sleep so that I'll be rested and fresh the next day. I'd like to be a college student in the subway because you can see from the books they're carrying, their heads must be stuffed with all kinds of knowledge, that they could sit down with you and chat forever about Shakespeare and Samuel Johnson and Dostoevsky. If I could go to college, I'd make sure to ride the subways and let people see my books so that they could admire me and wish they could go to college too. I'd hold up the books to let people see I was reading Crime and Punishment by Fyodor Dostoevsky. It must be grand to be a student with nothing to do but listen to professors, read in libraries, sit under campus trees and discuss what you're learning. It must be grand to know you'll be getting a degree that puts you ahead of the rest of the world, that you'll marry a girl with a degree, and you'll be sitting up in bed the rest of your life having great chats about the important matters. But I don't know how I'll ever get a college degree and rise in the world with no high school diploma and two eyes like piss holes in the snow, as everyone tells me. Some old Irishmen tell me there's nothing wrong with hard work. Many a man made his way in America by the sweat of his brow and his strong back, and it's a good thing to learn your station in life and not be getting above yourself. They tell me that's why God put the pride at the top of the seven deadly sins, so that young fellas like me won't be getting off the boat with big notions. There's plenty of work in this country for anyone who wants to earn an honest dollar with his two hands and the sweat of his brow, and no getting above himself. The Greek in the diner on Third Avenue tells me he's cleaning up Puerto Rican quitting him. Would I like to work an hour every morning, come in at 6, sweep out the place, mop it, clean out the toilets? I could have an egg, a roll, a cup of coffee, and $2, and who knows, it might lead to something permanent. He says he likes the Irish, they're like the Greeks, and that's because they came from Greece a long time ago. That's what a professor at Hunter College told him. Though when I said this to Eddie Gilligan at the hotel, he said the Greek and the professor were full of shit. That the Irish were always there on their little island since the beginning of time. And what the hell do Greeks know anyway? If they knew anything, they wouldn't be slinging hash in restaurants and babbling in their own language that no one understands. I don't care where the Irish came from, with the Greek feeding me every morning and paying me $2, adding up to 10 for the week, 5 for my mother and her shoes, 5 for me, so that I can get proper clothes for myself and not look like Paddy off the boat. I'm lucky to have an extra few dollars a week, especially after Tom Clifford knocked on my door at Mrs. Austin's and said, "Let's get the hell out of here." He said there's a huge room the size of an apartment for rent up on 3rd Avenue and 86th Street over a shop called Harry's Hats. And if we shared the rent, we'd still be paying $6 a week, and we wouldn't have Mrs. Austin watching every move. We could bring in anything we liked, food, drink, girls. "Yes," says Tom, "girls." The new room has a front and a back and looks out on Third Avenue, where we can watch the L pass right before us. We wave at the passengers and discover they don't mind waving back in the evening on the way home from work, though very few wave in the morning because of the bad mood they're in, going to work. Tom works in the night shift at an apartment building. That leaves me on my own in the room. It's the first time in my life I ever had the feeling of freedom. No bosses. No Mrs. Austin telling me put out the light. I can walk all around the neighborhood and look at the German shops, bars, cafes, and all the Irish bars on Third Avenue. There are Irish dancers at the Caravan, the Tuxedo, the Leitrim House, the Sligo House. Tom won't go to the Irish dances. He wants to meet German girls because of his 3 happy years in Germany and because he's able to speak German. He says the Irish can kiss his ass, and I don't understand that because every time I hear Irish music, I feel tears coming, and I want to be standing on the banks of the Shannon looking at swans. It's easy for Tom to talk to German girls or Irish girls when he's in the mood, but it's never easy for me to talk to anyone because I know they're looking at my eyes. Tom had a better education in Ireland than I did. He could go to college if he liked. He says he'd rather make money. That's what America is there for. He tells me I'm a fool for breaking my ass working at the Biltmore Hotel when I could look around to find a job with a decent wage. He's right. I hate working at the Biltmore Hotel and cleaning up for the Greek every morning. When I clean the toilet bowls, I feel angry with myself, because it reminds me of the time I had to empty the chamber pot of my mother's cousin, Lemon Griffin, for a few pennies and the loan of his bike. And I wonder why I'm so particular about the toilet bowls, why I want them to be spotless, when I could give them a swish of the mop and let them be. No, I have to use plenty of detergent and make them sparkle, as if people were going to have their dinners out of them. The Greek is pleased, though he gives me a strange look that says, "Very nice, but why?" I could tell him this extra $10 a week and the morning food is a gift and I don't want to lose it. Then he wants to know what I'm doing here in the first place. I'm a nice Irish boy, I know English, I'm intelligent, and why am I cleaning toilet bowls and working in hotels when I could be getting an education? If he knew English, he'd be in a university studying the wonderful history of Greece and Plato and Socrates and all the great Greek writers. He wouldn't be cleaning toilet bowls. Anyone who knows English should not be cleaning toilet bowls.